Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations. Today is Friday, May 22nd, 2015, and for the final day of this week, I am filling in for the final time for Jeff Gamet. I am Dave Hamilton here in Durham, New Hampshire, and with me today, Brian Chaffin. How you doing, Brian?
I am doing well, man. I'm doing well. It's Friday. It's been a busy week.
It's been fun doing this show together every week, every day.
It has been actually.
Yeah. Oh, we have a sponsor for the week. That is Lynda, LYNDA.com/TDO. That's where you're going to go to get 10 free days of their training videos. We'll talk a little bit about that in a moment, but we have two topics to talk about today, Brian. We're going to talk a little bit about fingerprints and Google, as well as heart rates and Apple Watch.
Yeah, fingerprints and Google. You want to start with Google?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, so the story is that Google is going to be launching fingerprint authentication in the next version of Android, which is called Android M at this point. Either they're dropping the candy monikers or they haven't decided to call it Milky Way yet or something. Now, the originator of this piece is BuzzFeed, of all places. And the story was light on details, light on depth. They didn't cite any specific sources, but I would imagine that it's pretty solid. But what Google is reportedly going to do is have a system level fingerprint authentication system that will, at the very least, allow you to log into all of Google's services with the fingerprint.
Okay. So this sounds, at least in terms of the, and I've always called Apple's fingerprint Touch ID a feature of convenience more than a feature of security, but and we can talk about that if we so desire. But this sounds like a similar level of convenience. Instead of having to type your password when you go to log into certain things, you get to just do it with your fingerprint, which is way simpler.
Yes, and remember that Touch ID didn't do much more than log you in at first,
right? Log you into your phone. That's right.
To your phone, right?
Yeah, that's true.
And it took, Apple took that experience and took that data and took that performance and then slowly started adding stuff. You can make purchases with it. Now, of course, you can do Apple Pay purchases with it.
Well, and you can do the third-party apps, too.
And third-party apps. But that was an addition, though.
That's right.
Right. That wasn't there out of the gate. So
oh, absolutely not. That's
if
right.
Google is only going to let you log into their services, that doesn't mean that more won't come. But I have a huge question about it.
What's your question?
Well, my question, Dave, is Apple has an advantage here, a theoretical advantage at the very least, and that's that it controls the hardware and the software.
So all of the hardware and all of the software.
Right.
That's right.
And I mean, in this case, they bought their own fingerprint authentication company. They're making their own chips. They designed their own so-called or something that they named the secure enclave that stores your fingerprints locally on the device.
Yeah, it's like a separate area of storage. I don't want to say RAM, but a separate area of storage that is only accessible by is only writable by the OS, right? I mean, it's very, very secure in their manner of speaking. Yeah.
In their manner of speaking, right. And these are all really good things when it comes to your fingerprints and using them as any kind of authentication tool. Google does not have that advantage. So my question is, how is Google going to actually do this?
Well, okay, so I'll answer your question, and then we'll dig back in and see. And then I want to ask the question: Does it matter, right? Because the Google could do this in one of two ways, really. They could store it in an area on the phone, like they store any other data on the phone, right? You know, your login credentials, let's say for whatever you're logging into, right? I mean, it could just be stored there, or they could store it on their servers. That's kind of a stretch. My guess is that it would be local on the phone. There's no real reason to store it on their servers. I guess there could be. If you have more than one Google device, it might be nice to sync your fingerprints between them and unlock that way. I mean, right?
I actually have a counter to that, though.
Okay.
There is an advantage to Google storing it on the servers because they do control those servers. If they're storing fingerprints locally on the phone and anything, like a section of RAM that they're setting off, right? Because
it wouldn't be RAM. It would be storing it in the flash storage of the phone.
So they'd have to do that. They'd have to mandate that devices that support this have some kind of hardware ability to do it.
But every phone that runs Android has local storage. I mean, Android itself lives on that local storage, as do all of your apps and all of that stuff.
But if it's not protected, if it's not in a protected area, it could well be much more accessible to any kind of malware.
And this is why I wanted to ask, and therefore, does it matter? Because you bring up a good point, right? When we compare it to Apple, who has gone through a great deal of PR to make sure we understand that our fingerprint data is stored securely on the phone, and that data, whatever that data is unreadable by anything. That is comforting to a user. I think it's important to note Apple is not storing your fingerprints on the phone, nor would I expect Google to store your fingerprints on the phone. What they do is they store a calculation that is made from your fingerprints, right? So the scanner scans your fingerprints and it collects all these data points that presumably enough of them that make your fingerprints unique. And then it stores a hash of that. Right. And I this is the way I understand it. And if someone listening understands it differently, please do tell us. But as I understand, what Apple's doing is they take a reading of your fingerprint and then they hash that and store the hash. That's similar to what happens on your Mac and really any other Unix based operating system these days, where you type in, it doesn't store your password. It stores a hash of your password, right? A hash being the result of a calculation that happens on your password, and it is a one-way calculation, okay? So you can't take the hash of your password that's on OS X and reverse it and get your password out of it. It's simply impossible the way the calculation works. What happens when you log into OS X is you type in your password, it hashes what you typed in and then compares that against what was stored, and if it's the same, then off you go. And there's some other unique data that's pulled in so that the hashing is even more secure, but it never during the process is your password decrypted. And as I understand it, the same thing is happening with your fingerprint data. Is in a matter of speaking, hashed, the calculation is pulled, it's hashed, and then either stored if you're storing a new fingerprint or compared against what is stored to see if in fact the fingerprint that is being presented matches after this calculation what the fingerprint that we stored was the result of that calculation. So
with that in mind,
yep,
it is in fact possibly wouldn't matter if the bad guys could get that information.
Well, it would matter a lot less. And this is why they did this on Unix with the password file years and years ago. It didn't used to be this way. But as soon as you think about this process, you realize, oh, this is way better, because that way you can actually make the password file world readable, meaning anyone on the system can read it. Now, they've even gone beyond that. Now you have a shadow password file and that's not world readable in the same way. But initially, that's what it was. It was like, okay, well, if we hash them, who cares if somebody sees the hash? That's the point, right? And so, yeah, the bad guys could get it, or it wouldn't be as bad if the bad guys got it. Now, with fingerprint data, I haven't really thought this through, but let's muse on what would happen if the bad guys got the hash of your fingerprint. Probably not a whole lot, right? I mean, I may be missing something here as I'm starting my thought process about this, but it's not the end of the world.
Maybe not. Right. Maybe not. Maybe not. And that's the thing is we don't actually know
the problem with your fingerprints,
where that could go.
Right. The thing is, you know, with a password, if somehow that data gets compromised, you can change your password and basically all your problems are negated. Right. The bad guys have your password hash. You want to be careful about it, even though you know how the calculations work and you know it shouldn't matter. You go ahead and check it. And then that's that. Well, with your fingerprint, you can't change your fingerprint.
But like wouldn't a new hash, wouldn't a different hash be generated if you simply even took new readings with your fingerprints?
Well, no, in theory, it would not be, right? Because if that were the case, then your fingerprint would never, you'd never be able to unlock your phone. Yeah,
of course.
Yeah. So I'm using the term hash here. It may be exactly accurate. It may be an approximation of what Apple's doing, but Google certainly could do it that way. And then it's less of a concern. And then even if they want to store it on their servers, I mean, there's still that one, you know, 10th of 1% where you stop and say, well, yeah, but I can't change my fingerprints.
It's true.
You know,
it's true. Which is why, I mean, you know, Google already stores our lives on its servers.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It may not. They have much more than our fingerprints. That's right.
Much, much more. And you know, I really wonder if anybody, I mean, like there was hay made about fingerprints with Touch ID at first. Do you remember like the knee jerk reaction, especially from the Apple haters, was like, you know, this stuff's going to be flying around the servers and people are going to steal it, despite the fact that that's precisely not what Apple is doing.
That's right.
And took a, I don't know, maybe a week for that sort of thing to go away, maybe even 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But I really wonder if anyone who's fully invested in the Google world is going to care, because they either are ignorant of what Google is doing or they don't care.
Right.
What Google is doing, what their business model is, the fact that they're the product, all these things that I at least have ranted about for a long time now.
Yeah.
And from that standpoint, I mean, if anything, I think I'd almost rather trust Google's servers over OEM's ability to implement some kind of hardware thing.
You mean for reading the fingerprint?
For storing it.
Okay. All right. Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, who knows? And the question is, I mean, it does lend itself to the question of how are they going to read these fingerprints with phones? They don't control all the hardware, right? So now do they have to mandate that, or not mandate, but if for this feature require that the phone has a fingerprint sensor?
Right. Would they do it that way, or were they?
Would it be possible? Hear me out on this. Could you possibly use the camera to do this?
Oh, that's interesting.
Right. If you take a picture of your fingerprint with the flash on your iPhone, there is data there. It's not, you know, the flash will light through your finger and you'll get some data. I mean, the focal point and all that is screwed up. But if you know that whatever is happening is going to be touching the camera sensor.
That'll be a nightmare if they try to go that route.
I had a heart rate sensor app that worked that way.
Yeah, right? it was based on knowing what the hardware was going to be too, and where the camera placement was going to be.
Well, yes, you're right. The hardware is different, but if as long as you could get the light, you know, enough light into your finger, then it would matter less, right? Because yes, it's going to be different on every device, but you don't need your fingerprint to jump from device to device. You're just worrying about this device again. So it does limit that. But
in the world of Android OEMs, you've got, I mean, you know, the different flashes. Oh, that would, that would just be, that would end up being a catastrophe. But
you're probably right. Yeah, that's true.
Another thing is that Lollipop, the current newest version of Android, is only on like 10% of Android devices. you know, they've gotten,
yeah, I know,
they've gotten about like a 10% penetration in a year.
That's because you got to wait for your carrier. It's a big pain in the neck.
There's all kinds of reasons for it.
Right.
But, so, you know, it's not like a lot of, there aren't going to be a lot of devices supporting Android M either.
Yeah. It'll take a while. That's true. That's true. Yeah. Hey, I do want to take a moment here and speak about our excellent sponsor, which, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, is Lynda at lynda.com/TDO. As I mentioned, that's where you go to get 10 free days of Lynda's fantastic training videos. Lynda hires experts in their fields, people that really know what they're talking about, people that could make, and some of whom do make, a career teaching this kind of stuff. Whatever it is you're going to learn about, they've got the teachers for this. These are professionals. These people really know not only what they're teaching, but how to teach it. These courses are built so that you can pace yourself through them however you like. And it really works well. I've taken some courses with this, Brian. I know you have too. Lynda, they have perfected the method of what I think is the future of education, right? And you get 10 days free through us here. But then after that, it's $25 a month, and you can take as many courses as you like for $25. And you can stream them to your iPad. You can stream them to your iPhone. Of course, you can watch them on your computer. For a little bit more each month, you can actually save them offline so that you can watch them, say, on an airplane or a subway where you don't have the connectivity. They really do a fantastic job with these things. They're video courses, but of course the videos vary from course to course depending on what the content is. If you're learning about something like Photoshop, well, you're going to see a screen video of the teacher walking you through actual Photoshop. So you're seeing it right there. It's like you're sitting over the teacher's shoulder. And the cool part is you can tell the teacher, hey, what you just showed me there, hang on 1 second, I want to try that here. And you hit pause and you go ahead and do it. And then you come back and you say, okay, great, let's resume. The courses all have course material that come with them. The audio of the courses is all transcribed just in case you had any trouble hearing somebody, or you're perhaps watching it where you can't do headphones. You can see what's being said as well as what's going on the screen. They've told, like I said, go ahead.
It's super convenient. It is a great way to learn stuff.
It really is. It really is. And you know, if you're listening to podcasts like this one, and you are into learning things from someone speaking to you, and this is the way to do it with the added visual elements that really send it home. So you got to check it out. lynda.com/TDO is where you're going to go to start that 10-day free trial. Yes, you can get that 10 days free if you just visit lynda.com, but then they don't know why you visited lynda.com. So if you just make sure to go to lynda.com/TDO, that way they'll know where you came from. We get credit for it. And that helps us because it shows them that their advertising works. And so we definitely appreciate that because we want them to come back, and that's a good thing. And, you know, you folks have sent us some fantastic ideas. We've shared them throughout the week. I encourage you to go back and listen to the spots if you missed some of the great examples. Again, it's lynda.com/TDO. Thanks to Lynda. Thanks to you. Thanks to everybody who sent in all their suggestions all week. I really appreciate it. So, Brian, it is time to talk about the second topic that we have here today, which is
the heart rate monitoring. Apple has just broken it, and everything just doesn't work anymore. Wait, maybe that's not the case.
The Verge noted that that prior to Apple's 1.0.1 update, basically the watch was taking your heart rate every 10 minutes. At least, or more frequently, if you were doing an activity or it noted that you had,
doing a manual check
manual checks, or you were in an actual activity. Like you said, I was going for a run or going for a walk, or if you were just more active, it would sense your heart rate more often.
The workout. If you do a workout, it's like every minute.
Yeah. Or more perhaps, but yes, that's right. Since the 1.0.1 update, all of that remains true, except for the baseline default time, and it is no longer every 10 minutes. It's some 10 minutes. Again, seems dependent on activity.
Well, you know, when I was going through, so it was users on Apple support forums that first started complaining about this. And then there's also users over at Mac Rumors forums who were also complaining about it. And that's what The Verge was writing about. I went through my own data, put a couple screenshots up. And if you can please ignore my alarmingly high resting heart rate, what I found is that I was seeing, like, you know, some 50-minute increments, some 40-minute increments, 30-minute increments, 20-minute increments, and still some 10-minute increments.
Right.
In addition to my own manual checks, because like you, I do tend to kind of obsess. Now that I know that I can find out what my heart rate is, I look for it.
Yeah, you can set that up as a glance on the watch to make it really, really easy to go and look at that. And yeah, it is handy.
I do.
Yeah. I am curious if you correlated the gaps with your activity, just in terms of standing and motion, not necessarily starting or ending workouts. Because I did. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. You finish.
Well, I was going to say, I did correlate it, and it definitely goes and tracks my heart rate less frequently when I am
particularly sedentary.
Yeah, sedentary. Yeah, that's the right word. Yeah, I was heads down this morning from probably about 7:30 a.m. till about 10:30, and my watch kept telling me you got to stand up, and I was like, yeah, but I'm busy. And I think it took a reading at 7:20, and the next one it took was at 10:30 when I got up. So it's definitely it's definitely watching that. Oh no, it took one at 8 a.m. I'm not sure why, but that's what went on there. Yeah.
Right. So the question, of course, I mean, this is an actual change. This is, I mean, you know, we've got strong proof that watchOS 1.0 took samples every 10 minutes, and that watchOS 1.0.1 is doing something different.
Yes, that's right, correct. Right. Yeah, there's no question about it. That's right.
The question is, does it matter?
I don't think so. I mean, it's been speculated, and it's easy to speculate that this would be done to preserve battery life, and that makes sense. Every little bit that you can do to preserve battery life is fine. Does it matter? Certainly from a battery life perspective, not for me, but I mentioned that I don't have any issues with the way I use the watch and battery life. I could probably go 2 days without needing to charge it.
This is not the kind of thing that's going to give you a third day.
No, no. But, you know, it again, like you said, why not? Right. And does it matter in terms of your data? Probably not. I mean, if your resting heart rate, you know, the other thing that we don't know is what happens with a brand new watch that's running 101, because what we know is this has happened on watches that came from 1.0 to 101, where you've already developed enough of a data set to consider a baseline for your resting heart rate, right? So
you're projecting there because you got your watch pretty early. But what about the person who got their watch the day before 101 came out?
Well, we don't have data from that person. And that's what I'm saying is, you know, we don't know what the decision point is. Is it simply 1.0.1 slows this down across the board? Or is it only for people that have developed enough of, is it like, for example, going to do 2 days worth of 10-minute increments, get you a baseline, and then just back off? That would be the smart thing to do.
Well, maybe. I looked where you took this, and that was that Apple made a change that it's checking your heart rate based on your activity level.
Well, those are not mutually exclusive ideas. I mean, I think you do, you know, you could do 10, it could be argued, and we don't know what Apple's done because we don't have enough data yet. But it could be that for the first, 48 hours that you're wearing the watch, it checks every 10 minutes, gets you a baseline. And then from then on just does it based on the perceived activity level.
Yeah, maybe. I doubt that, man. I doubt. I think it's just we don't have enough data.
We don't have enough data. That's it.
We don't have enough data. But so here's to whom it matters. It matters with people who are maybe a little bit obsessive compulsive, about looking at things like this. I'm looking at us, Dave.
Yeah.
And it matters possibly to people who are very, very, very interested in their fitness levels and or maybe even people who are tracking medical data for medical reasons. To most folks, it won't matter.
No, I don't think it. And even those people, I don't think it actually matters. But time will tell. We'll hear from it. We'll hear from you about it.
Speaking of time.
It is that time. Thanks for hanging out with us today and all week. Again, Lynda, LYNDA.com/TDO. All these stories that we mentioned here, you can find at MacObserver.com. And we will see you next week.